Today is Friday, January 31st, 2011. I'm Matthew Willis.
And I'm Adam Melham, and this is News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us? Just a big mistake.
Good evening, it's 5:07 and time for a full hour of independent news.
Today we will be discussing drama at the recent AMS meeting and an intriguing notion put forward by a UBC linguistics professor. Then we'll have our new health segment with Sharon Hundle. We will also be joined by Colleen Kimmett of the internet magazine thetie.ca to discuss implications of internet metering.
All this plus a special feature on Stand UBC's Debating Darfur panel discussion and your weekly weather forecast right here on News 101, your source for independent, local, national, and international news.
But first, the headlines from...
One second.
Just one moment, please, folks. It's just going to take us a little bit. I hope you're all having a fantastic Monday with us today.
How are you doing, Adam? How is your Monday today?
You know what? I'm just stupendous, Matthew Willis.
That's good, Adam.
This is just so much fun. Good. Now, we're going to go to the headlines from Free Speech Radio News.
Speech Radio News. Republican politicians in Arizona have introduced a bill in the state's legislature that would eliminate birthright citizenship rights guaranteed by the U.S. Constitution. The bill supporters want to initiate a court battle that would review the provision which guarantees citizenship to, quote, all persons born or naturalized in the United States. A similar proposal was filed last week in Indiana, according to AP, and several other states are expected to introduce legislation soon. An American in Pakistan is being charged with murder after shooting two Pakistani men to death on Thursday in what he claims was self-defense. Several media reports have identified the man as Raymond Davis, a private security contractor employed by the U.S. government. Davis appeared in a Lahore court today, saying the two Pakistani men had tried to rob him while he waited at an intersection in his car. Student protests in Puerto Rico continued this week. Students are angry about tuition rate hikes in the University of Puerto Rico system. Media reports from the scene show lines of riot police moving in on scattered demonstrators, arrests, and the use of tear gas and rubber bullets. Students in turn block traffic and some threw stones at the police.
The important thing is that the country knows that in spite of the attempts of the Puerto Rican police to suppress our student movement, we are not going to stop our struggle, and we're going to continue independently like this in the face of these suspensions and the police violence.
Audio courtesy of Telemundo. At least 30 students were arrested during the actions yesterday. In Hungary, thousands of residents are protesting a new media law they say would severely restrict freedom of press. They gathered at a concert and rally last night in the capital. One protester spoke to AFP.
We just can't accept that there's no freedom in the press, and we want to read what we want and don't want the parliament to tell us what can we read or not.
The new law, passed in December, would establish a government panel that would screen the media for balanced coverage. But media freedom activists say the provisions are vague and could be easily abused. Many EU member nations have publicly criticized the new law. And last week, several members of the European Parliament placed tape over their mouths during an address by the Hungarian Prime Minister in a symbolic protest. And finally, the USDA has approved genetically modified Roundup Ready alfalfa for planting in the U.S. This comes after years of litigation surrounding potential environmental impacts. Watchdog groups like the Center for Food Safety are angry that the approval does not include cautionary provisions aimed at protecting organic and other farmers. The group says it plans to challenge the decision in court. And that's News Briefs for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
Thanks to FSRN for bringing us those headlines. Daily headlines and their full newscast can be found at FSRN.org. I'm Matthew Willis.
And I'm Adam Melham. And now it's time for your local news 101 headlines. In regional news, a recent report regarding the mass culling of 100 healthy sled dogs last April in Whistler has recently emerged. The dogs belong to Whistler-based Outdoor Adventures, who are suffering a downturn in business following the Olympics. The employee, who the Vancouver Sun reveals filed for post-traumatic stress disorder, killed the 100 dogs over 2 days, recounts a horrible and gruesome ordeal in which many counts of animal cruelty and unintentional wounding or inhumane killing are named. Marcy Moriarty of the BCSPA says that, quote, "I've no doubt he has suffered post-traumatic stress disorder, but there's a thing called choice. I absolutely would not have done this, and he couldn't have said no. This is a criminal code offense," unquote. She went on to describe the killing as a, quote, "massacre," unquote, and says that she is glad that the public will finally learn more about the sled dog industry. The RCMP have been contacted regarding the incident, but the BCSPCA are expected to be the lead investigators and will be trying to attain warrants to continue searching for further information.
In national news, UBC economics professor Kevin Milligan collaborated with Michael Baker, another economics professor from the University of Toronto, in a study that, quote, "found longer parental leaves did not have a positive impact on child development," end quote. The professors themselves argue that, quote, "the question is to ask what kind of bang are we getting for our buck here. If the only thing we're looking at was the impact on child development, then it would be a hard case to make," end quote. There's clear controversy over the validity of the economics professor's claims as it butts head with sociological and family studies research. According to Donna Lero, professor of family relations at the University of Guelph, quote, "the research that has been done is inconsistent at best, and it's largely because it's very complex and challenging to address," end quote. Currently, it seems that economic studies are not cut and dry conclusions to the issue of parental leave and its larger claims on child development.
On to wonderful campus news. AMS President Bijan Ahmadian was accompanied by a lawyer into the council chambers in response to a potential censor to be placed on him by the council. Ahmadian threatened legal action if the council passed a censor motion, which was brought forward in response to his more than scathing criticisms of VP External Jeremy McElroy. The Speaker of the Council, David Tompkins, has expressed disapproval of Ahmadian's tactics and pointed out that Ahmadian supported the censorships of Blake Frederick and Tim Chu last year for their human rights complaint made to the UN about tuition rates. Quote, "One of my rules is that all council members can speak their minds freely, which is why I get my back up when people threaten and intimidate them," end quote. Tompkins says if he decides to sue or not, Ahmadian's term ends February the 11th.
In campus news, a curious notion has been made by the Globe and Mail's Collected Wisdom column that asks if English speakers today would be able to understand an English speech made by Henry VIII, the British monarch who notoriously had six wives. UBC linguistic professor Fritz Neumeier responded by saying, yes, we would be able to understand a royal address from Henry VIII, only, however, if he spoke slowly and with a great deal of clarity. To a 21st century audience, such a speech would sound something roughly Shakespearean, which, with a few exceptions, can generally be understood. Professor Fritz makes the interesting claim that King Henry would, quote, "sound more like a North American than a Brit," end quote. Needless to say, it would be a treat to hear Colin Firth attempt such a spectacle.
Thank you so much for all those new stories. Now it is time for our new health segment with Sharon Hundle. Sharon, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. Today in health news, revisions to the dietary guidelines for Americans were issued. These guidelines parallel the newest recommendations of Canada's Food Guide, which was issued back in 2007. However, this year's Dietary Guidelines for Americans, known as the DGAs, included specific recommendations about eating more fish and seafood, as well as more practical advice for adopting healthier eating habits such as eating breakfast and avoiding fast food joints. Now, there is some controversy about how effective and accurate these guidelines are, considering the DGAs have been issued every 5 years since 1980, but overweight and obesity have surged in the past two decades. Nonetheless, four core action steps were developed encouraging Americans to better balance the number of calories they eat within the amount they burn off, favor more vegetable and plant-based foods and increase seafood intake, lower consumption of foods high in added sugar and fat, and meet federal recommendations for physical exercise. For the average adult, about 150 minutes or 2.5 hours of moderate activity each week is recommended. So that sounds like what we've all heard before, right? So another issue that is getting a lot of buzz within Canadian and American nutrition groups is the need for us to reduce our sodium intakes. The Sodium Working Group in Canada consists of 25 organizations, and they're strategizing to reduce added and dietary intakes to less than 1,500 milligrams a day. That's two-thirds of a teaspoon of salt, which is not much at all. So finally, other changes included in the current DGA revision were intended to make the guidelines more practical and accessible so Americans can act on them and start to eat healthier. A website will serve as a portal for questions as well as background on the guidelines. The good news for Canadians is that we already have a useful website like this called EatRacker.ca, developed by the Dietitians of Canada. It calculates your caloric requirements, food guide servings, and intake against recommendations, as well as your activity levels. Finally, it generates a health report with useful links to find more information about particular nutrients. More information, including the link, can be found on my blog. This link is on CITR.ca following the segment. So that's your health news for this week. I'll be back next week to highlight upcoming health events on campus that you must check out. So until next time, stay happy and healthy. Thank you.
We're going to take a quick break, but stay with us. I'm Matthew Willis, and you're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Government and Big Pharma have entered into a secret conspiracy in which secret government contracts are sold to Big Pharma that allow for secret chemicals to be placed in coffee seeds, all under the watchful eye of Big Coffee, who is secretly working with other world forces, all in a sinister plot to get alien embryos in our coffee so Big Pharma can sell us alien contraceptive pills. Or, if you'd rather get some rational news, check out Radio Free Thinker, the radio show / podcast that promotes skepticism, critical thinking, and science education. Every Tuesdays at 4 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
I'm troubled by shapeless fears. Who can live in the modern world without catching his share of them? I hope I've landed on my feet this time.
Need a place to rent? Have a place for rent? AMS Rents Line can help. AMS Rents Line is an easy-to-operate, touch-tone, and web-based system that connects thousands of landlords with UBC students looking for off-campus housing. UBC students can search the ads for free or place a two-week posting for $5. To view current listings, visit www.amsrentsline.com.
Welcome back to News 101. I'm Matthew Willis.
And I'm Adam Melheim. You are hearing us on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, or online at our website, citr.ca, broadcasting live from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia. It's currently 5:20 p.m. and time for our segment with the internet magazine, thetaiyi.ca. We have Colleen Kimmett on the line to talk about internet metering. Hi, Colleen, how are you?
Hi, I'm well, thanks.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much for being here with us.
You're welcome.
If you could just please give us some background on this issue and what is so passionate about it to you.
Sure. Well, net metering, or usage-based billing, is when an internet service provider charges per byte in addition to basic network access fees. And Bell Canada and other large telecom companies basically lobbied the CRTC, the Canadian Radio, Television, Telecommunications Commission, for the right to usage-based billing. So recently, CRTC agreed and decided to allow net metering, and it kicked up a huge storm of protest. One organization, openmedia.ca, has been behind this the whole way, and the Taiyi has also published lots of articles, in particular by Michael Geist, following this issue. And last week, our editor David Beers published an op-ed in the Globe and Mail, and the same op-ed the following day in the Taiyi that was the most Facebooked story on the Globe and Mail. And when it was published on the Taiyi, it received 567 tweets and 1,000 Facebook likes, which is the most I've seen on a Taiyi story. So clearly it's an issue that you know, people are really care about. I think it strikes at a nerve that this feeling of powerlessness that the companies that own the internet infrastructure are getting away with something that they shouldn't be.
I agree with you on the terms of powerlessness, but what effects, if this is to be passed and accepted, what effects do you see this having on internet users within Canada in terms of their net usage?
I'm a little fuzzier on this part. I'm been reading different things. Some of what I've read is that this will only affect a small percentage of people who are, who are downloading or using a lot of material. For instance, Bell has a cap of 25 gigabytes, and after that, it costs $1 to $2.50 per gigabyte over that. But I've been checking in on different forums and reading about people who are saying they're getting hit for $60 to $100 more than what they typically see on their internet bill. However, the outcry, the public outcry, has had some effect. Smaller internet service providers didn't want this. They didn't want net metering because they felt it would make them less competitive. And because of the surge of public outcry, the CRTC did rule that independent internet service providers will get a 15% discount. So it's something. I mean, I think it shows that the voices of the people have been heard to a certain degree.
So, Colleen, what's making this happen now? Why not have these charges in place before? What's so special about this happening now?
It's just been the decision-making process by the CRTC. I'm not sure what prompted the initial request from Bell and the other large telecom companies, but mm-hmm. It took about 3 months for the CRTC to make this decision.
So what do you think the impact this is going to be on, say, the arts community or movies, music, other downloadable things that, you know, no doubt in this day and age people have ready access to via the internet?
Yeah, well, I think it will limit the sharing of multimedia in particular. I mean, this issue was sort of... when it was first introduced, the argument was that well, we're only punishing people who are downloading vast amounts of porn. But, you know, the National Film Board, for example, just made available its entire archived library, and there's some great stuff in there. And I think it could also hinder research as well, people who have to download large volumes of information. I mean, everything is online now, and those bytes can really add up when you're looking at journal articles or books or other research materials or multimedia materials like that.
Thank you very much. I was reading the David Beard's article that you mentioned before, and near the bottom of it, he mentions the Stop the Meter petition. And
yeah,
I was wondering if you can give us some specifics about that. Sorry.
Sure. That's being organized by openmedia.ca. So far, they've reached, I believe, 160 signatures, and their goal is at least 200,000. So you can find out more at openmedia.ca.
That's beautiful. Also, just to finish off, could you please just give us an update on the TIE? What do you guys have coming up for us?
Well, we've got a great green building series on the go right now. I've written an article for it, and it's being led by Monty Paulson. And it's, I think it's interesting because he, you know, demonstrates that green building doesn't have to be fancy or exotic or expensive, and that in fact it has the potential to really create a lot of green jobs. I think, you know, Vancouver, we think green building and we think of the convention center and the athletes' village and all these big fancy buildings, but you know, Monty's series shows that it doesn't have to be like that, that it can be for everyone.
Perfect. Colleen, on behalf of all of us here, I want to thank you so much for being on the air with us.
You're welcome.
And we look forward to hearing from you in the future. Thank you very much.
Okay, bye-bye.
We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM.
A video of the incident was posted on YouTube.
Until now, Canada's internet has been an open network and a level playing field for free speech and innovation. All that is under threat. A handful of companies want to limit what you can access on the internet. In May, SaveOurNet.ca led a successful campaign pushing net neutrality to the top of the Liberal Party website. Now, both the New Democratic Party and the Liberals have official policies supporting net neutrality. In addition to that, the CRTC has recently issued new rules intending to prevent the actions of some internet service providers from limiting certain types of traffic and content on the web. But the battle does not end there. To tell the government that net neutrality is a vital part of our democratic society, and for more information, visit www.saveournet.ca. This message is brought to you by saveournet.ca and CITR 101.9 FM.
It's now time for a special report on Stand UBC's Debating Darfur panel discussion.
Okay, so this past week, the UBC Club students Taking Action Now, Darfur or Stand UBC, held a panel discussion entitled Debating Darfur, in which they focused on this month's referendum for the independence of Southern Sudan. We were lucky enough to cover this discussion between Vancouver Quadra MP Joyce Murray, UBC Political Science Professor Arjun Chowdhury, and UBC student and Sudanese refugee Adit Abit Elizabeth. We now bring you some highlights of this night.
And tell me if I'm too close to the mic. So, I'm Adi Burton, and I'm president of Stand UBC. And again, thank you so much for coming, and we're really excited about this special panel discussion that we're going to have tonight about some pretty interesting topics. So I can see that everybody here shares the interest, so I can go on about it as long as I like, right? last year, we held a similar panel event in March with Senator Mabina Jaffer, Professor James Sedgwick, and student refugee Yasin Kiraga. And as you can see, there's a sort of similar composition today. We have our student refugee Adit Elizabeth, MP for Vancouver Quadra, Ms. Joyce Murray, and Professor Arjun Chowdhury from the Political Science Department. So the goal of this panel discussion is really to explore these issues from an interdisciplinary and point of view and many different perspectives. And something that's really important to us is the audience perspective. So the way this is going to work tonight is we are going to have about a short presentation in the beginning just to introduce you guys to the topic, and 40 minutes of directed questions. So a question will be asked. Each one is targeted to a specific panelist based on their experiences and interests. And however, all panelists may answer any question. Afterwards, there'll be 30 minutes for audience questions, and then we'll have a wrap-up and schmoozing. Okay. So, let's just get started. Okay. Here we go. So the current situation in Darfur, for those of you who are unaware, Darfur is a region of northwestern Sudan, and it is what's occurring there, the conflict that's occurring there today, is considered the first genocide of the 21st century, and it is an extremely awful situation. And just so you know the statistics, just so you can have a general framework of the issue at hand, is that many put the estimate at 400,000 or more murdered in Darfur, and it's really impossible to know exact numbers. More than 2.5 million people have been displaced, and over 4.5 million people have been affected by this conflict. And yes, there are lots of problems. The key players in the situation in Darfur: on the one hand, there's the Sudanese government led by President Omar al-Bashir. We know now that the Janjaweed militia, which carry out the attacks on the villages in Darfur, are affiliated with the Sudanese government, so we put them together. So there's the Sudanese armed forces, which collaborate with the Janjaweed militia, and the Sudanese police. On sort of the other side, we have the rebel groups. The two main rebel groups are the Justice and Equality Movement and the Sudanese Liberation Army. These two groups have splintered and splintered and splintered over the years, so there are many rebel groups now, and that's a huge impediment to any peace process. And on the hand of relief efforts, there's the United Nations forces, the African Union forces, which is now a hybrid force, and the relief NGOs. So today's issue is the thing that I thought that I should just mention it to you, so those of you who are unaware can have a framework for the specific questions that are going to be asked. The referendum in South Sudan and the indictment of President Omar al-Bashir. So the referendum took place from January 19th to 15th in 2011, so it was very, very recent. The people of South Sudan went to the polls to vote on whether or not to secede from the north of Sudan. This was the culmination of the 2005 peace process, which ended a decades-long civil war that devastated the entire region. Experts say that the vote will be overwhelmingly in favor of independence, though the official results will not be released for a few more weeks. The result of the referendum, which may split Africa's largest nation, is highly uncertain, and there are numerous risks, especially because of the large amount of oil that is involved in this conflict. And the topic has been the focus of international news, not only because George Clooney has lent his face to the cause, but also because the potential impact of the unknown here is enormous and massive. The second issue that you guys might want to know some detail about is the indictment of President Omar al-Bashir. So on March 4th of 2009, the International Criminal Court issued an arrest warrant for Sudan's President Omar al-Bashir, the first sitting head of state to ever be indicted. He was charged with war crimes and crimes against humanity initially, and on July 12, 2010, the International Criminal Court added 3 counts of genocide to the arrest warrant. The ICC has jurisdiction over those 3 crimes: genocide, crimes against humanity, and war crimes, and those are considered the gravest crimes that it is possible to commit under international law. Since his indictment, al-Bashir has been largely avoiding international events, but with the support of the Arab League and the African Union behind him, he's been able to conduct a certain amount of political ventures. And in September, al-Bashir visited Kenya, and this was important because Kenya is actually a signatory to the document that created the United Nations, and he should have been arrested there, but he didn't. So this is a really important issue because it's really going to show how much effect the International Criminal Court can have and how the international human rights law is going to develop in the future. So that's why this issue is really important, and we will discuss it during the panel. Just a little bit about STAND. So STAND was founded in 2005, and it's a student organization that operates all across Canada and campuses and high schools. We unite students from different backgrounds and academic specialties with a focus on humanitarianism within Canada and abroad. STAND highly encourages students to engage in political advocacy concerning genocide, most specifically in Darfur, and on the national level, we do some work with the Congo. Why we do it is we are an advocacy organization and not a humanitarian organization. And while we always try to support humanitarian organizations, we believe that humanitarian aid is important, but it doesn't address the underlying causes of the problem. Genocide is, by nature, a different type of animal. And there's often a lack of political will to go forward and stop it. And often, if there are reactions, they are very reactive actions. So STAND's goal is to make stopping genocide a cornerstone of Canadian foreign policy so that when genocide occurs, Canada can react swiftly with a comprehensive policy set. If you're interested in learning more about that, you can check out the Will to Intervene document. Almost done. So what we do, although genocide is a complex issue, advocacy should be easy. So we have some ways to understand the current situation and to work with STAND. So the first thing you can do is to become a member, and many of you are, so good job. Attend an event. All of you have done that. Good job. Write a personal letter. You can do that in the back if you like. Engage your MP's office. Many of you are doing that now. You can participate in STAND's campaigns or volunteer your time. So we have our tool hotline 1-800-GENOCIDE, from which you can call the office of the Prime Minister, the Leader of the Opposition, or the Minister of Foreign Affairs. So that's a very effective tool, and we're really excited that we're able to offer that free to all Canadians and non-Canadians. So yes, you can use that whenever you like, day or night. And we also have our Stand for the Dead campaign, which maybe I'll talk about some more later, but you can also donate to Stand if you want. So just a quick thing about our speakers tonight. We are very excited to have these speakers. Professor Arjun Chowdhury is an assistant professor in the Political Science Department at UBC and does research in international security and political development. He has published articles and commentary in Foreign Affairs, Security Studies, Security Dialogue, the European Journal of International Relations, and Borderlands e-Journal. His ongoing research focuses on autocratic survival strategies and the effect of counterinsurgency campaigns, and the transition from imperial to international system, which is relevant here, as you can see. For those of you who are interested, he is today teaching Poly 260, Poly 360, and Poly 562. Our second panelist today is Abid Elizabeth. She is a first-year student in arts at UBC, and she's interested in political science also. She was born in South Sudan, and she came last year from Kenya as she was living there in a refugee camp called Kakuma. Adit is a WISC-sponsored student at UBC, so she's with the World University Service of Canada. And our third speaker is Ms. Joyce Murray, a Member of Parliament for Vancouver Quadra, which is this constituency. She was first elected in 2008 and is a member of the Liberal Party of Canada. She has been an advocate for environmental and climate change issues, creating jobs and strong economy through innovation, human rights, women's rights, and preventative health. And interestingly for us tonight, in December 2010, Ms. Murray introduced the motion on transparency for supply chains of conflict materials and products sold in Canada, which may be fueling sexual violence in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. So that is a very important piece of legislation. We're very excited about that. Okay, so again, what we've done is we've crafted questions for each panelist based on their specialty and experience, and we've given them to them in advance, so hopefully they have some sort of answer prepared. And the questions will be asked in five categories, and any panelist may answer a question. So if you would like to answer a question that's asked to somebody else, please, 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 just signal to me and we'll be happy to include you. Afterwards, we're going to open up the questions to the audience. And so, Ajit, it's good that you have the microphone, because the first question is directed towards you, so you can be the first to answer. So the first category of questions that we have, I'm just trying to move through themes, is the referendum. And you just heard a bit about it. So I wanted to ask Adib on behalf of Stand. How do you think that secession will impact the people of South Sudan? Do you think it can happen peacefully? And are you optimistic about a new South Sudanese government and its ability to function in the region?
Okay. To all Sudanese, including me, most of us think that separation is freedom to all of us. And separation means freedom because the world that people have experienced and the life they have lived for 23 years in war, they are tired. And as we will see in the turn of the boat, if you watch, almost 98% vote for separation. And all of them now are excited. They are happy to welcome the new country. And if you go now to Sudan, you will have people from the south saying, what will be the name of the new country? Will it be called Sudan? No, we don't know that name. Maybe we might have another name. So they are happy. And they are almost, they are happy that, and they hope in July this year, the new independence song will be declared. And with all the commitment that the South government is showing, they ensure that peace prevails, and immediately now they are working forming the new constitution. They want to commit themselves for democratic system of government. So they are now forming the new constitution. And on July, the former government dissolves and the new government will be formed. It is automatic. The source will succeed. There will be an independent country very soon. Thank you all.
Thank you. Does anybody else want to take a shot at that? Okay, cool. Let's move to the next one. So for Professor Chowdhury, how do you think the referendum in South Sudan will impact the region in the long term? Especially the rest of Sudan, and most particularly the people in Darfur. And I know there's been some debate about this, and I'm interested to hear your opinion.
So, can you hear me in the back, or do I need to use the mic? You can hear me? Okay, excellent. Well, first of all, I'd like to thank Stand for organizing this, and I'm very grateful to have been given another soapbox. On a serious note, well, in the long run, in the long term, at this point, it is impossible for me or anyone else to say until it's clear what the government of South Sudan looks like. I mean, it's absolutely true that it will most likely be a secession. But the question is, what will be the power sharing agreement between the groups in South Sudan? That's the first question, which is important. The second question, which is important, is also what is going to be the oil revenue sharing deal between the South and the North? Because the entire viability of South Sudan as an independent unit will be based on how much oil revenue it can get. Because as many of you may know, most of the oil is actually in the South, but the South will be landlocked, and the pipeline, a pipeline at this point through which the oil can get out, runs through the North, right? So you can think about it this way: the South has the oil, and the North has the pipeline. So until we know how that is going to look, it is impossible to say what the long run situation is. I mean, in the medium term, all we can say is this: we can say that the demands for secession have been given a major incentive. And secondly, you can say that in the medium term, the institutional situation, the state institutions, etc., in South Sudan are going to be quite weak. But beyond that, until we see what the new government looks like, it's very hard to answer that question.
Thank you very much. Does anybody else? How about let's make a system? If you would like to answer the question, just signal to me, and we'll go to you quickly. For Adit again, how do you think al-Bashir, the president of Sudan, will react to secession, should it occur in a peaceful way?
In this way, I think al-Bashir will react to the results. He will definitely accept the result because it didn't have any choice. The problem was included in the comprehensive peace agreement that the South will determine whether they will separate or unite with the North, depending on how they are treated by the Northern government within the 5 years. So the Bashir government doesn't have any alternative. And the result, the succession will be determined by the result. Bashir aggressive reactions might be seen in the Abyei region, the oil rich of Abyei, which is said this year that I don't have any problems. And what I see, the problem that the southerners and the northern might pay and they might enter to war again, is the oil-rich area of Abyei and the border demarcation. If we see Sudan and how it will be separated, the Abyei line at the border, it cut centrally. So they say that I don't have any problems, but the Abyei region will remain under my administration until the final decision will be reached, which the southern government are committed. They don't want war. Yeah, most of the cities are tired. So they think that doesn't matter. The Abyei region will be negotiated until the agreement will be reached with intervention of the international community. So I think...
Okay, thank you. For Ms. Murray, as the south of Sudan will likely secede from the north, splitting Africa's largest nation, as I said before, after decades of civil war and strife, how has Canada been involved in this critical phase of international history and of African history?
Well, Canada's has been involved, and this Sudan is in the top three countries that it supports financially. In terms of aid, so some $800 million has gone into the Sudan, focusing on things like diplomacy, reconstruction, human rights since 2006. I think some of the downsides of Canada's participation is that we supported the dispersion of the high-impact brigade. And that's not the technical term for it, but it was a multi-country response unit that we supported that being disbanded, which is, I think, a lapse of leadership. As a medium power, Sudan is a place that Canada could and should provide a leadership role start to try and reclaim some of the respect that we've been losing on the world stage because of some of the actions of the conservative government, like abrogating our responsibility under the Kyoto Accord, for one minor example. I think some of the things that we are hoping and will be pushing for the Canadian government to do is to really take the longer view, because there's going to be potentially 6 months that are very vulnerable to conflict especially along the border area. So most of Canada's aid has gone into the capitals of north and south. We need to be very engaged in the border area. We need to be thinking about how to prevent out-of-control conflict as minority groups cross the border once the succession is finalized. I think it's a very, very vulnerable time. And we have enough experience now that we should really anticipate those months and not just think about the short term. So the other thing that we would encourage the Canadian government to do is create relationships with the leaders in the South. And they have been not doing a good job of that. There needs to start being made those bridges. We need to recognize the South like the day that that's finalized and not wait, as we did in Kosovo, for a length of time. And I think, lastly, we need to be clear, and I think Canada's been reasonably clear, but we need to take a leadership on the contention and the determination that Darfur not fall off the radar with the focus on the succession and the issues with South Sudan. So that's a few comments.
Thank you. For Adi, I think you sort of answered this question already, but what are the feelings that are prevalent amongst the South Sudanese people, especially compared with others in Sudan and elsewhere, right now, according to your perception and experience? Maybe you have like a personal story to share or something like that? I understand that you couldn't vote because the nearest polling station was in Calgary. Okay.
Yeah. So the situation is so very exciting. Many people, they are celebrating, although, yeah. So, and including me, I'm celebrating. The Sudanese are all happy. Do I call them the South Sudanese or the Sudanese? I don't know. Okay, whatever the case. So they are happy and they are planning for the new country. I don't know whether the new country will come with all happiness and forever, but that's what they are thinking. They have all hope for the new country. And like the other people in Sudan, the Darfur and the Nubian who are in the north, they want to separate from the north. They are tired of Bashir regime. So they are not happy. If I think mostly this idea that it is better for Sudan to remain united, because they see us the alternative, that what is the problem is not the whole country. The problem is the Bashir regimes. We then think that with cooperation of all people, the Bashir regime will be overthrown and the new government will be formed where everybody will be freely represented. So the Sudanese are happy while others are not happy. They want to separate again, or they want their own government like the North, like the South. Thank you.
Thank you. You exactly led into the next question. So our next sort of theme is about developing nations and emerging nations. So this question is for, I'm sorry, the next few questions are for Professor Chowdhury in this section, but if anybody else wants to respond, please. With the South Sudan likely to emerge as a new nation, can we expect similar changes in borders in Africa and abroad? And is this the next phase as Africa moves away from the colonialist borders that have been set quite some time ago?
So this is actually a really tough question. So probably the best way of thinking about it is to understand the referendum in two senses, both of which I think are positive. The first is that it is clearly a verdict on the government in the north as being venal, repressive, all those things. But secondly, it's also, and this is where it gets a little bit risky, right? It's also a vote against autocratic regimes, of which there are many all over Africa. Now, the reason why this becomes a little bit dangerous is that the whole situation after the Civil War since 2005, right, is that the mediation between the two sides has been done by the African Union. The majority of peacekeepers on the ground are peacekeepers of the AU. And the AU, as you all know, is a group of states, most of whom are led by autocratic leaders. Right? So insofar as the referendum on secession in Sudan is going to be upheld, it is going to create major incentives for disgruntled groups in the states of, say, Libya, for example, to ask for, if not secession per se, certainly a referendum on these things. And then it's going to be a problem to see how the AU reacts, right? Because if they say, okay, we will accept, well, they have to accept. But if they say that there's going to be a secession in South Sudan, and we are going to keep our peacekeepers there to mediate, they are implicitly legitimating a secession over there. So how are the populations in their own states going to react? So that's really the hard question going forward, because you can clearly see that this is going to create a demand elsewhere in Africa, right? For, if not secession per se, certainly a referendum which will be a similar sort of verdict on a bad autocratic regime, right? But that's the that's a challenge, and a lot will come based on how the AU and the leaders of the AU react. Are they going to allow it and support it, or are they going to push back against it? Because most of the mediation in conflicts in Africa is done by the AU. They have to be on board for these things to have medium-term chances of success.
That was our special coverage of Stand UBC's Debating Darfur panel discussion. For more information, visit www.standubc.com. Also, our listeners may be interested to know that since the discussion, South Sudan has indeed voted to secede from the rest of the country. Now, going from Debating Darfur panel, we go to Adam Yanush with the Arts Report.
The Push Festival is all about pushing boundaries, particularly between different media and styles, blurring the lines between theater and visual arts and dance and music. Rouge is one such show that seems to blend All of them. The only thing that can be easily pinned down about this show is its theme, red. From blushing to blood, red is a very provocative color, and it provided artist Julie André T. with a lot of material. Here she is talking about what the color rouge means to her.
Well, first of all, I mean, it's a primary color, so it's impossible to make it any kind of mixed color to get red. Mm-hmm. And what I like about that, too, is red was the color, first color that we named in the history of language and history of linguistics.
Really?
Is after naming black and white for the night and the day, which is black and white is not considered a color.
Right.
But rouge, red, is a color, and it was the first color that we name as human being. And for me, it kind of tells everything. It's the essence of everything. It's our blood, right. It's life. And it, of course, goes through different meanings in terms of love, violence, and et cetera, et cetera. But it somehow... the essence of a lot of things.
Right, it's very basic, and so it has it's sort of a primary ingredient in a lot of humanity. So does that mean do you have something to say in this show about humanity, the human condition?
I have a lot of things to say, I guess, since it's kind of about, you know, there's maybe 100 of actions in that show, and it's going through a lot of different emotions or feelings by doing different actions, and like a lot of objects in the show. So I guess it's a bit like zapping, you know, the TV, things going very quick and you get very fast messages. And I guess it's all like a very fragmented, if we call message, it's very fragmented. And for me, it's poetry. That's the first thing. And then the viewer is free to their own story.
And now in your shows, I just wanted to get a sense of what you do because you're not just moving, right? It's not dance as like ballet where you're sort of doing pirouettes on the stage, right? It's much more complex than that.
I would say it's not dance at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, tell me about that.
Well, I guess I would almost like prefer saying like some kind of experimental theater in a way. Mm-hmm. And I come from visual arts. That's my first training, if you want to say that way. I make installation. I make exhibitions. My approach to performance on stage is very visual. So somehow, when you look at the show, it's starting from a very virgin stage to building slowly a landscape in front of your eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And everything is, for most of the objects, I make small actions. And my only text is, what color is this? It's red. And basically, I'm asking this question for 1 hour, but a lot of people said it's almost like a soundtrack, because the way I'm repeating that text is, that sentence is so, in so many ways, that it's not like the words anymore that means, it's the way that you're saying it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is complete with the actions that are the objects I'm going to use, or the way I'm going to say it. Sometimes I'm singing it, sometimes I'm screaming it, sometimes I'm praying with it. I prefer it as performance art, and it's been built to be on stage, and it's on the edge of being theater, dance, which is for me not so much important to put it in a category.
Give it a label, yeah.
Yeah, putting a label, but it's kind of a painting, you know? It's like, it's a live painting that is built in front of the viewer with many actions. It's very rhythmic, and it's complete with sound and light. So it's like a live picture. Tableau vivant, like we say in French.
Tableau vivant, says Julie-André T. And Rouge is coming to the Scotia Bank Dance Theatre on February the 3rd, and goes until the 5th at 8 p.m. And there is also a post-show talkback on February the 4th, and that should be very interesting. Now, advanced tickets range from $26 to $32, and at the door they go from $28 to $34. You can get them from tickets tonight.ca.
And that's our program for January 31st, 2011. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. Also, I'd like to share